Polyakov turned, and the crowd behind parted to let him through and sullenly followed him away. The Larsen Manganese riflemen were the last to turn, but the implacable stillness of the customs officer outfaced them, and finally their leader muttered an order, and they turned and walked back down the quay. Walked until he snapped another order and they clumsily organized themselves into a march.
"Mr. Scoresby, your rifle, if you please,"
said the young man.
I'd rather give it back to Captain Van Breda, seeing that it belongs to him."
He heard hasty footsteps behind him and turned carefully again to see the captain hurrying towards them. He had evidently heard the last exchange because he said,
"Mr. Scoresby, I must thank you. I have nothing to pay you with except the rifle itself. Please, take it, please. It is yours."
"Very handsome, Captain. I'll accept it with thanks."
"And now put it down,"
said Haugland. Lee bent to lay it on the ground.
"And your pistol?"
"It doesn't work."
"Yes, it does. Put it down."
Lee did so and then straightened up, feeling dizzy. For a moment the sounds of the harbour receded. The cry of the gulls, the raised voices from the coal tanker and the crane driver across the water, the splash of the dredger, the striking of the customs house clock. And then it seemed as if a dark cloud had sprung up out of nowhere and enveloped the sun, because the colour drained from the world and everything dimmed. It only lasted a moment, and then he found another officer's hand steadying his arm and came to his full senses again.
"Follow me, please,"
said the officer, and set off briskly towards the end of the quay. As Lee passed the schooner, he could see the crew unseating the heel of the derrick, and a man casting off a rope, and Captain Van Breda hurrying up the gangplank and shouting an order.
"Where are we going? I thought your customs house was back there."
"It is,"
said the lieutenant, and left it at that. But as they passed the last warehouse, Lee saw a launch tied up at a flight of steps, in the customs and revenue colours of navy and white. The engine was chugging quietly, and a rating held the painter tight through a ring in the wall to keep the boat steady as the first officer stepped on board. Lee crouched to pick up Hester, who whispered,
"It's all right, Lee. Everything's fine."
Deeply puzzled, he stepped onto the launch and sat down in the little cabin as the other two officers followed. The sailor cast off, and one of the officers took the wheel and opened the throttle. Lee looked back at the schooner, whose bow was already swinging out away from the quay. The young officer had laid Lee's pistol and the Winchester on the bench opposite where Lee was sitting, and Lee could easily have reached either of them. He sat still and quiet, holding Hester close, until the launch had passed the dredger and rounded the lighthouse and was pitching briskly in the waves of the open sea.
"All right, I give up. What the hell is going on?"
"Mr. Scoresby, please take your pistol,"
said Haugland.
"And I believe the rifle is also yours."
"Well, now I'm dreaming,"
said Lee. He took the revolver and spun the cylinder, which ran smoothly and surely.
"Where are we going and why?"
"We are going round the headland to the Barents Sea Company depot, where you will find your balloon, inflated and ready to leave. Here, by the way, is your luggage from the boarding house."
He took Lee's kit bag from a locker. Too numb to be surprised any longer, Lee nodded and took it silently. The officer at the wheel changed course, and the boat pitched and rolled in the lively sea. Lee watched the rocky shoreline and saw a seal surface, and then another and another.
"They are fleeing from the bear,"
said Haugland.
"Where's he?"
"On his way to the depot. He is not interested in seals for now. He has something to give you."
"Well, this is a damn surprising morning."
"The fact is this, Mr. Scoresby. There is a struggle going on throughout the northern lands, of which this little island is a microcosm. On one hand, there are the properly constituted civil institutions, such as the Customs and Revenue Board, and on the other, the uncontrolled power of the large private companies, such as Larsen Manganese, which are dominating more and more of public life, though they are not subject to any form of democratic sanction. If Mr. Polyakov wins this election, he will make life easier for Larsen Manganese and its fellows, and worse for the people of Novi Odense."
"I thought he was campaigning against the bears. I thought that was his whole platform."
"That is what he wants simple people to think."
"Oh, Simple people, eh? Well, he certainly worked that trick.
Until now, he has been very careful to remain just within the law. But trying to deprive Captain Van Breda of that cargo was a step too far. Whoever hired those gunmen was also, of course, committing a crime, but I have no doubt that we shall find it impossible to prove any connection with Polyakov. I am also sure that his lawyers will manage to confuse the court and secure an acquittal in the matter of the cargo. In short, Mr. Scoresby, we are grateful to you for dealing with an unpleasant problem. Your action was all the more honorable in that you had no personal interest in the matter.
Ah, I don't think much about honor,
Lee said uncomfortably.
Well, we are grateful, as I say. You will find your balloon fully provisioned, and there is a good east wind.
Lee looked ahead through the spray-splashed cabin window. They were rapidly approaching the mole sheltering the depot, and Lee could see his balloon, as the young man had promised, already inflated and swaying in the wind. It was a case of thank you very much and don't come back, he thought. As the launch passed the mole and slowed down in the calmer water inside it, Lee felt gingerly inside his coat for the damage to his shoulder. It hurt like hell, but as far as he could tell, it hadn't done any structural damage. As for his ear, he felt that too. There was a bite-shaped gap at the top big enough to fit a finger in, and it was still bleeding.
Before you put me in my balloon and cut the tether and wave goodbye, is there somewhere I can fix myself up? I take it you have no objection if I patch up the holes I seem to have acquired.
No objection whatsoever,
said Haugland. The officer at the wheel cut the throttle and the launch drifted neatly to a halt beside a wooden jetty. A moment later it was secured, and Lee stood up to follow the customs men ashore. There was a huddle of low buildings around the company offices, and they took Lee first to sign for the return of his balloon. The clerk looked at him without surprise.
You found someone to fight with, then?
Lee saw that the storage fee had already been paid, and so had the bill for the gas. He pushed the release form back across the counter without a word. The fact was that he could think of nothing to say.
This way, Mr. Scoresby,
said the lieutenant. He led Lee to a washroom, where Lee painfully stripped to the waist, cleaned himself as best he could, and with Hester's help examined the damage. He was glad to see that McConville's bullet had gone through the muscle of his shoulder and out again. It might have clipped the bone on the way, but at least he wouldn't have to dig the damn thing out. As for his ear, that was too bad. He could still hear with it.
Wasn't all that pretty anyway,
said Hester.
Pretty's when I had,
said Lee. The officer knocked on the door.
Mr. Scoresby, there is a medical man here who will look at you.
Lee opened the door, shivering in the brisk wind, and found Lieutenant Haugland, smiling, standing on the cinder path next to Yorick Birnesen. The bear was carrying a bundle of dark green in his mouth, which he dropped into the officer's hands.
Blood moss. Let me see your wounds.
A truly remarkable specific,
said the officer, as Lee turned to show the bear his shoulder.
It has antiseptic and analgesic properties superior to anything in our hospitals.
Yorick took a few strands of the moss and chewed them briefly. He dropped the pounded mess into Lee's right hand.
Lay it in the wound and bind it up. It will heal quickly.
Well, thank you kindly, Yorick Birnesen. I appreciate that.
He did his best with the soggy moss. The lieutenant tore off a strip of adhesive tape and bound the wound for him, and Lee pulled his shirt on again. While his head was still inside it, he heard quick footsteps on the path and another man's voice, one he recognized. He held still a moment to think what to do, and then he pulled the shirt down to see the dark-suited figure of the poet and journalist Oscar Sigurdsson, notebook in hand, talking eagerly to the lieutenant.
And it occurred to me that... the hero himself! Mr. Scoresby, I congratulate you on your safe escape! Would it be too much trouble to ask you for an interview about this remarkable episode?
Lee looked around. The jetty was only a few yards away.
Why, certainly, Mr. Sigurdsson. But I think we need a little privacy. Come with me.
He led the way out, and Sigurdsson followed eagerly. When they were at the end of the jetty, Lee pointed out to sea.
You see that spot on the horizon? Might be a ship?
Sigurdsson peered, sheltering his eyes.
I think so,
he began, but he got no further because Lee stepped behind him and swung his foot hard against the poet's backside. With a cry of alarm, Sigurdsson shot forward and into the sea, arms flailing. Lee walked back to the washroom and said,
Mr. Sigurdsson seems to have fallen into the water. He might need a hand to get out. I'd oblige myself, but unfortunately, I'm indisposed.
I think it is lucky for us that you are leaving, Mr. Scoresby. Peterson, bring him ashore, and bring him out if you would.
Another man ran to the end of the jetty with a lifebelt, but before Lee could see Sigurdsson rescued, there was a sound of yet more footsteps, and in a hurry this time, and as Lee was pulling on his coat, around the corner of the buildings came another of his acquaintances.
Mr. Vasiliev, you come to say goodbye?
The economist was out of breath, and his eyes were wide with anxiety.
They're coming this way, the Larsen security men. They have orders to kill you and the bear. Polyakov is furious.
Yorick Birnerson growled and turned to the sea, but Vasiliev went on.
They have a gunboat on its way, too. There's no way out.
There's one way. You ever flown in a balloon, Yorick Birnerson?
Yorick? No, Mr. Scoresby, I have not.
Yorick? Got it. And I'm Scoresby, but make it Lee. Well, now's the time, Yorick. Mr. Vasiliev, good day, and thanks.
He shook hands with the economist, and the officer accompanied Lee and the bear to the balloon, which was shivering with impatience to be free of its tether and take to the sky. Lee checked everything. It was all in good order.
Go,
said Haugland, and shook his hand.
Oh, take your rifle.
He handed Lee the Winchester, which Lee took with pleasure. He felt as if it had been made for him. He wrapped it in oilcloth before stowing it carefully inside the gondola.
You ready, Yorick?
This is strange to me, but I will trust you. You are a man of the Arctic.
I am? How's that?
Your demon is an Arctic hare.
A what? I thought I was a damn jackrabbit.
Arctic hare,
said Yorick briefly, and Haugland nodded. Lee was as amazed as she was, but there wasn't time to stop and discuss the matter. Yorick clambered over the side into the capacious gondola, having tested the strength of it to his own satisfaction, and then Lee joined him.
Lieutenant Haugland, I'm obliged to you, sir. But I still don't see how you knew who I was and where I was boarding.
You may thank Miss Victoria Lund, to whom, as of this morning, I have the honor to be engaged. She told me that you had been very courteous towards her.
Lee tugged off his hat and scratched his head, and then rammed his hat on again and tugged it low because he was blushing.
Please, convey my respects to Miss Lund. I congratulate you on your engagement, sir. Miss Lund is a remarkable young lady.
He dared not look at Hester.
Well, let's get away. Yorick, if I need two hands, you might have to help me out a little till that blood moss kicks in. Stand clear now.
He released the tether, and the balloon sprang upwards with the swift assurance of a craft that knew where it was going and was eager to get there. It felt like a living thing. Lee loved that first rush of speed, and so did Hester. He checked all his instruments and looked around the sky, and then looked down at the rapidly diminishing scene below. With the help of his field glasses, Lee made out a little shivering figure wrapped in blankets on the jetty. Along the road from the town, a convoy of armored cars was moving towards the depot, and from further down the coast, a gunboat was speeding in the same direction with a great deal of flashy spray. Further away, he could see the schooner just passing the lighthouse. The crew had raised the sails, and the ship was catching the strong east wind that was speeding the balloon on its way. Yorick was crouching low on the floor of the basket, keeping absolutely still. At first, Lee thought he was asleep, but then he realized that the great bear was afraid.
You reckon young Lieutenant Haugland will deal with those Larsen Manganese bullies?
Lee said, to distract him. He had no doubt himself.
Yes, I have a high regard for him.
Lee thought that the bear's high regard would be a thing worth having. Hester moved along the floor, closer to the bear's head, and settled down to speak to him quietly. Lee left her to it and checked the barometer, the gas pressure gauge and the compass again. Not that the compass was much of a help in these latitudes. And then he took out the rifle, looked it over thoroughly, cleaned it and oiled it with a new can of machine oil, which he found, to his surprise, in the toolbox. He wrapped it up again carefully before making sure it was safely strapped to a stanchion. He'd learned his lesson. He looked after it well for the rest of his life, and 35 years later, the Winchester was in his hands when he died. Looking around his unnaturally tidy gondola, he discovered some neatly wrapped packets in the starboard locker, and opened one to find some rye crisp bread and hard cheese. He also discovered that he was very hungry. Some time later, when they were high in the blue sky and everything was well, Lee opened his kit bag to take out his warm waistcoat. His clothes were more neatly folded than they had ever been, and there was a sprig of lavender on the top.
"Well, Hester, this has been a surprising day and no mistake. How's York over there?"
"Asleep. What's surprising? You acting the fool and kissing that lavender ain't surprising."
"No, I don't reckon that is. I could lose my heart to that girl. Flying with a bear. Now, that's surprising."
"More surprising if you left him there. You wouldn't do that. If we couldn't take him, we'd stand and fight beside him."
"Well, all right then. Finding out that you're an Arctic hare, that's surprising. Damn, I was surprised."
"Surprised? Why the hell were you surprised? I ain't surprised,"
said Hester.
"York's right. I always knew I had more class than a rabbit."
To accompany this story, Once Upon a Time in the North includes some fragments of printed and written ephemera, documents from another world that have arrived by chance in this one, and which might throw a little light on some aspects of the narrative. Lee Scoresby's copy of The Elements of Aerial Navigation was missing the back half. Here is the last page he was able to read. "The Elements of Aerial Navigation, Chapter 7, Procedure for Landing a Balloon. Once aloft in the Empyrean, with both gas and ballast in reserve, the aeronaut has little to fear. It is when he approaches the Earth with a view to resuming his lowly status as a creature of gravity that the pilot of an aerial vessel encounters the first real danger of his flight. And yet, by taking the simplest and most basic precautions, he may safely and easily negotiate the perils of landing and emerge from his craft with all the nonchalance proper to a prince of the air. The first and most essential matter to bear in mind is..." And here the page was ripped. The rest is lost. This is an article from the Novioudense Courier.
"Shocking affair at harbour. Two men slain in warehouse shooting. Villain and accomplice bear flee by balloon. By special correspondent, Oscar Sigurdsson. Two trusted employees of the Larsen Manganese Company were mercilessly slaughtered yesterday in the course of their duty, and two others were grievously wounded. The affair took place in the peaceful surroundings of the harbour, where a vessel had been held up for some days following the refusal of its captain to pay the storage fees due on a cargo he claimed he had the right to load. It appears that the captain, Van Braden by name, engaged the assassin to achieve by force what his own obstinacy had failed to bring about. The perpetrator of this appalling crime appears to be a foreigner, one Leigh Scroby, a Texan, who came to our town by balloon. He is evidently a cold-blooded and calculating killer. Your correspondent had a brief interview with him on the evening before the tragic events at the harbour, and it was clear, even in the civilised surroundings of our town hall, that here was a man whose deceitful and violent nature made him unfit company for those of a peace-loving disposition. He openly carried a pistol, and one, furthermore, which was well-tended and ready for action. What makes this crime even more shocking in the eyes of decent citizens is that the murderer was joined in this dastardly action by a bear. This savage brute, degraded even by the low standards of his race, had evidently conspired with Scrooby beforehand to carry out the atrocious deed. The two villains fled the scene of their crime together, aided, one is sorry to say, by the interference of the customs authorities, whose high-handed officer, in placing legalistic correctness before anything else, prevented the swift and stern application of natural justice. Those with a shrewd understanding of political matters will find in all the circumstances of this tragic affair further proof, if proof be needed, of the far-sighted wisdom of Ivan Dmitrovich Polyakov, the leading candidate for mayor in the forthcoming election. Mr. Polyakov writes in the current edition of the Novy Odense Courier and Telegraph, page 7.
Here are two letters, which might explain how these items happened to be gathered together.
St. Sophia's College, Oxford, 18th of October. Dear Tom, it's going to have to be Econ Hist, because there simply isn't any way of examining what I know about the alethiometer. Ideally, there'd be a panel of wise men and women who could test me on it and judge the merits of a thesis and so on. But there's only me and Dame H, and I'm beginning to get beyond the things she knows about anyway. I'll have to keep on with that privately, and, well, privately. At least with Econ Hist, the body of knowledge is nice and clear, and I've got a really good subject, and lots of documents and stuff, personal knowledge, etc. And if I get all the postgrad qualifications, I can teach it and earn a living. So, how does this sound as a title for my dissertation? Patterns of Trade in the Arctic Region, with particular reference to independent cargo balloon carriage, 1950 to 1970. It must be a winner. Yours, L. St. Sophia's College, Oxford. Tuesday, the 2nd of January. Dear Dr. Polstead, sorry to bother you with this, but I wonder if you could advise me about a small point. I've got a number of items of printed matter to enter into the bibliography for my dissertation. Some of them are scraps, really, not much more than ephemera, but they all build up a picture, and the thing I need to know is how to enter them correctly if they aren't obvious things like books. Also, when the item I'm referring to in the text is, for example, a cutting from a newspaper that isn't going to be available anywhere in Oxford, or England for that matter, and so won't be easy for the examiners to check, would it be necessary to provide the actual cutting? I could do that easily enough. Some of my bits and pieces are precious for personal reasons, but I dare say the examiners will be careful to return them intact. With thanks, yours, Lyra.
Some documents from the authorities of the University of Oxford. Lyra's Oxford. Certificate for dissertations submitted in master's courses in the Faculty of History. This certificate should be placed in a sealed envelope, bearing on the outside your candidate's number only, addressed to the chairman of examiners, and it should be taken by hand to the examination schools in the High Street and left in the designated receptacle. Candidate number
23.
Name?
Lyra Silvertongue.
College?
St. Sophia's.
Title of Master's Program?
MPhil in Economic History.
Title of Dissertation?
Developments in Patterns of Trade in the European Arctic Region, with particular reference to independent cargo balloon carriage, 1950 to 1970.
Number of words used?
28,950. I declare the following. 1. The dissertation I am submitting is entirely my own work, unless otherwise indicated by citation or quotation. 2. No substantial portion of it has been presented for any other degree course or examination. 3. It does not exceed the prescribed word limit for the degree, including footnotes, excluding bibliography, any appendices for which specific permission has been obtained, and any English translations of passages quoted in another language.
Candidate's signature.
Lyra Silvertongue.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Once Upon a Time in the North, written and narrated by Philip Pullman. Featured in the cast were Nigel Whitmey as Lee Scoresby, Sean Barrett as Yorick Bernison and Ivan Polyakov, John Chancer as Pierre Morton, Pierre McConville, Andrew Branch as Oscar Sigurdsson, Tim Bentinck as Captain Van Breda, Hayward Morse as Vasiliev, Teresa Gallagher as Victoria Lund, Paul Panting as Lieutenant Haugland, Jane Collingwood as Olga Polyakova, Garrick Hagen as Mr. Argard, Liza Ross as Hester, and Joe Wyatt as Lyra Silvertongue. Other parts were played by members of the cast. This program was produced and directed by Garrick Hagen for the Story Circle. Executive producer, Orly Moskowitz. This program was recorded at Motivation Sound Studios in London, England, where the engineer was Norman Goodman. Wolfgang Dienst was the post-production editor, and the music was composed by Peter Ponson. Text copyright 2008 by Philip Pullman. Production copyright 2008 Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.